From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Iraqi dissident writer Kanan Makia. In his new book, he reports on the Iraqi government's 1988 campaign to annihilate the Kurds. And he criticizes Arab intellectuals for keeping silent over escalating cruelties in the Arab world. Makia wrote the bestseller about Iraq, Republic of Fear, under the pseudonym Samir al-Khalil. Also today, satirist Harry Shearer, on his career long before he became a satirist. We'll hear about his days as a child actor on the Jack Benny show, Leave It to Beaver, and in such films as Abbott and Costello Go to Mars and The Robe. Shearer's career from The Cleavers to The Simpsons will be the subject tomorrow at the Museum of Television and Radio in New York. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. As the House Judiciary Committee began an inquiry into the 51-day siege of the Branch Davidian compound in Waco, Texas, the basic question was the same it's been since the compound burned down on April 19th with adults and children inside. Who is to blame? NPR's Pas Cohen reports.
The answer from top officials, including Attorney General Janet Reno and FBI Director William Sessions, while more detailed than ever before, also remained basically the same. They and several members of Congress placed the blame with Branch Davidian leader David Koresh, who they called a madman willing to let his own children burn alive. Attorney General Reno said no one will ever know if the deaths were avoidable, but praised federal agents' restraint and said the use of tear gas seemed the best option.
Allowing the status quo to remain was not going to lead to an ultimate peaceful resolution.
But Michigan Democrat John Conyers said Reno had been right to offer her resignation. You can't put guns, barbed wire, the FBI, and the Secret Service around them, sending in sound 24 hours a day, Conyers said, and then wonder why they do something unstable. In Washington, I'm Pas Cohen.
President Clinton has named a former New York City police commissioner to head the federal anti-drug campaign. The job went to Lee Brown, a 55-year-old career officer who's headed police departments in New York, Atlanta, Houston, and Portland, Oregon. Brown said he'd draft a comprehensive anti-drug strategy that would include interdiction and law enforcement, but would also put greater emphasis on education and treatment. As fighting surged in Bosnia today among Muslims, Croats, and Serbs, Yugoslav President Dobrica Čosić deplored new sanctions against Yugoslavia. The sanctions are to punish Serbia for helping Serb forces in Bosnia. NPR's Silvia Poggioli reports from Belgrade.
UN officials reported fresh battles in central Bosnia between Muslims and Croats, and Sarajevo radio reported Serb shelling of the Muslim-controlled Bihać area in northwestern Bosnia. UN aid officials in the besieged Muslim town of Srebrenica in eastern Bosnia reported clashes on the outskirts between Muslims and Serbs. In Belgrade, Yugoslav President Dobrica Čosić told a press conference that the UN sanctions that went into effect yesterday have made Serbia and Montenegro into a concentration camp patrolled by NATO air forces and navies. In what was seen as a plea to the West not to intervene militarily in Yugoslavia, Čosić proposed an urgent summit meeting of Bosnia's warring sides, together with the presidents of the permanent members of the UN Security Council. This is Silvia Poggioli in Belgrade.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost about 2 points to close at 3,413.5. This is NPR News. Treasury Secretary Lloyd Bentsen called on Japan today to provide more financial aid to Russia. Bentsen said the industrialized nations need to move quickly to support the political and economic reforms of Russian President Boris Yeltsin. He said Japan was in a better position to help than any major country because Japan has run a budget surplus in recent years. Tomorrow's the one-year anniversary of the outbreak of violence in Los Angeles. Today, three men accused of attacking trucker Reginald Denny and 12 other motorists in the opening minutes of the riot appeared in court. But the case continues to address issues far afield from the original indictments charging attempted murder. Kitty Feldy of member station KCRW reports.
Judge Sean Outerkirk was supposed to decide whether the three defendants are being prosecuted unfairly because of their race. That former District Attorney Ira Reiner loaded up the charges because the defendants are black. But the ruling was postponed when defense attorney James Gillen accused Judge Outerkirk of being biased against the defendants because his fiance was Reiner's secretary.
How can Judge Outerkirk fairly and evenly evaluate R. Reiner's testimony when he basically has a sexual relationship with R. Reiner's former executive secretary?
Judge Outerkirk said his relationship would not affect his judgment. Another judge will decide whether Judge Outerkirk is too biased to make this decision. The trial is set to begin in mid-July. For National Public Radio, this is Kitty Feldy in Los Angeles.
President Clinton is dismissing suggestions that he delay the release of his health care reform plan until Congress approves the details of his budget. The comment was a response to Budget Director Leon Panetta, who suggested delaying action on the health care plan so the administration can focus on getting the budget package through Congress. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. During the Gulf War, my guest was known as Samir al-Khalil, the pseudonym under which he wrote the bestseller about Iraq, Republic of Fear. He's since gone public with his real identity. He is Kanan Makiya, an Iraqi dissident now living in exile in the United States. His father, Muhammad Makiya, is one of the Middle East's most respected architects. Kanan Makiya has written a new book called Cruelty and Silence, War, Tyranny, Uprising, and the Arab World. Part of his book is about the Iraqi government's campaign to annihilate the Kurds. This 1988 campaign of systematic slaughter, known as the Anfal, has been described by one human rights group as the clearest case of genocide since World War II. Makiya secretly entered northern Iraq from Turkey last year to investigate the campaign of annihilation. It was the first time he'd been in his country in 22 years. He gathered testimony from survivors of the Anfal. He believes that 100,000 people were killed and are now buried in mass graves.
When you look back at the record, as I looked back at newspaper cuttings and so on from the 80s, late 80s onwards, you know there were, for instance, refugees pouring out of northern Iraq into Turkey and into Iran, who were talking and telling stories which were sometimes making their way into the international press. This is before even the gassing of Halabja. But nobody could really make sense of these stories. I mean, it's as though something so terrible had happened that nobody wanted to believe that it was really happening. It was, couldn't quite take it at face value. Each particular refugee could only tell you their own particular story. Nobody had added all the stories together and said, "Hey, look what this means. This is something other than." So everybody had a horror story, and they looked like just that, you know, mere horror stories, accumulating individual stories. But they had a name. That name is the Anfal campaign. And they had a structure. And they had, in the end, a shape, which is what I tried to explicate. And now a pattern. So they add up to something much bigger, which came towards the end of the Gulf War. And it corresponds to a growing brutalization of society as a result of years and years of warfare, starting from the Iraq-Iran War in 1980 onwards. The climactic moment of that brutalization, that escalating cruelty, was the Anfal campaign. I think in the North and in the wake of the Gulf War, it was the way in which the uprising was suppressed. That is another completely untold story, which when you realize what the Republican Guard did when they entered into cities like Najaf and Karbala, leveling of cemeteries, burning of libraries, which contain manuscripts that go back centuries, many of which have not even been properly recorded because they're run by clerics who don't have modern, say, methods of entry form and so on. But these are very valuable resources. Cultural heritage of the country was deeply damaged. The role of Najaf as a historical center of religious Shiite learning was seriously cut, if not destroyed for a whole historical period. Every cleric was rounded up, students of religion were rounded up, every male Shiite was rounded up and killed and disappeared, and many people were collectively shot as example to others. Houses were raided. The scale of the atrocities is quite extraordinary.
You've expressed your disappointment in the lack of reaction among other Arab activists and Arab intellectuals to the kind of campaign of annihilation of the Kurds and other violations of human rights in Iraq.
Yes, very, very strongly. What I just described to you, the uprising inside Iraq, there is not one prominent Arab intellectual, not one, that empathized with these people who represent the overwhelming majority of the country. I mean, something like three-quarters of the provinces of the country were in the hands of rebels, north and south of the country, for days, varied from place to place, 3 weeks at most, 4 or 5 days in other places. Not one. Religious institutions were sacked. Holy cities were attacked. Libraries were burned. Unbelievable things were done. Neither the religious authorities in other parts of the world, like in the Azhar or in the famous mosques and religious places of the Arab world, nobody spoke up. None of the secular intellectuals spoke up. No Palestinians spoke up and said, this kind of repression, because you have to, what Saddam Hussein did in repressing this uprising is just, it was barbarous beyond belief. Nobody spoke up, and nobody spoke up about the Kurds, the Anfal. Nobody, in fact, spoke up generally about the brutalities inside Iraq. But even more general than that, I claim, by and large, Arab intelligentsia does not want to deal with the harsh realities of its own world. The brutal realities. 15 years of civil war have led to 150,000 dead Lebanese. 1 million people have emigrated. A country that was the center, the heart, the hope of the Arab world has been turned into desolate place, lost its best minds and its best spirits. Syria, massacre in Hamad, 20 to 40,000 people dead. Not only one book in Arabic by the Muslim Brotherhood, which no one pays any attention to because it's by the Muslim Brotherhood. No secular Arab intellectual says anything about it. What's going on here? What's going on? I'm calling upon Arabs to make that cruelty the most important thing. Nothing else matters. Nothing compared to this. The book is a call for restructuring the values of politics and culture as to what is not important in Arab politics.
I'm just trying to think through your charges and to think, well, how true is it that Arab intellectuals are not speaking out about dictatorships in Arab countries and the suppression of human rights in Arab countries? And
Let me just qualify. We're in a radio conversation. It's hard to be precise. There are individuals who spoke up wherever possible, wherever I know them. Their names are in my book. I try to show that there is an undercurrent. There are young Arabs out there who feel the way I feel and think the way I do. I don't claim that this is some sort of mission of some kind. No, they are out there. But the dominant discourse, the main language of politics and culture, has not made these an issue. That is the language that I myself grew up with. I was part of. That is, I was formed politically on the 1967 war and the rise of the Palestinian movement. That's the fundamental formative experience into which I entered politics, like my whole generation, by and large. That experience took us down certain paths in the 1970s, early 1970s. But then came the Lebanese Civil War, the Iranian Revolution, the Iraq-Iran War, the one catastrophe after another. I don't think that the generation that, by and large, that came out of that political experience has re-examined itself, looked at itself critically. It has constructed a language whereby all its problems, all faults of the Arab world are always blamed on outsiders. Now, not everyone does this. I'm saying the dominant discourse. Prominent intellectuals, and especially those who are in a position to say things without being afraid. I'm, again, not criticizing people on the West Bank, inside Syria, who can't say anything for fear of repression. That is not the point of this book. We don't know. I would never put my... I would say the same things they would if I were in their position. I know that. But those of us who are sitting in Western universities, those of us now, and there are now hundreds of thousands, if not millions of us. I said over a million Lebanese have immigrated in the last few years. You can see them upper side of New York. You can see them all over the United States, Canada, and so on. There are six daily Arabic newspapers coming out of London. There are magazines galore in London. London has turned into the new Beirut of the Middle East. Huge Arab, teeming Arab community with restaurants, with cultural products, artifacts of every kind, operating out of London when they used to operate out of Beirut. What's going on here?
Do you think that because there is a certain amount of stereotyping of Arabs in the West and a certain amount of discrimination against Arabs in the West, that perhaps some Arabs are more reluctant to speak out about problems in the Arab world.
Absolutely, certainly. That is definitely the case. Many, many people will admit that I'm saying things that are true. Most, in fact, Palestinian intellectuals that I know of, this is by far the most sophisticated and educated intelligentsia in the Arab world, know how bad the situation is in the rest of the Arab world, even those who supported indirectly Saddam Hussein. Yet they feel they have a way of thinking which I feel is part of the problem, and that is you never wash dirty laundry in public. That is what I'm challenging in this book. I'm saying there's nothing out there to hide anymore. It's hidden from nobody. We're only hiding it from ourselves.
My guest is Iraqi dissident Kanan Makia. You may know him by the pseudonym he used to write his bestseller about Iraq, Republic of Fear. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Kanan Makia, author of the new book Cruelty and Silence, War, Tyranny, Uprising, and the Arab World. You say that you came of age politically around the time of the 67 war.
Yes.
And that the plight of the Palestinians helped politicize you, and you identified with that. But now you think that Palestinians have been elevated to the status of myth of victimhood in Arab culture, that they're no longer people, they're symbols of suffering.
Yes, that is a deeply unhealthy trait that has developed in this part of the world, and it's in a sense a mirror image. The Palestinians have done to themselves what, to some extent, Israeli society has done. That is, transformed the Holocaust into a formative experience for its own national formation. For the Palestinian, the Nakba, the 48 disaster, the formation of the State of Israel, has been internalized in the same way that the Holocaust has been internalized in the formation of Israeli identity. Now, there's a part of this that, of course, is inevitable, and that is just a fact, and it even can be worked through. That's it. It is part of Palestinian identity, just as the Holocaust will always be part of Israeli identity. But if one stays locked in that, then one is closed to the suffering of others. One cannot any longer see what is happening to Iraqis, what is happening to Syrians. And the Palestinian cannot see even where the Israeli is coming from, and the Israeli cannot see where the Palestinian is coming from. This is the situation we have gotten locked into all over the Middle East.
So you think that the focus on Palestinian oppression has almost blinded people to the oppression of other people in the Arab world?
I think that it has not done the Palestinians themselves a service. It is true. I mean, what the cruelties that go on in the West Bank are truths, they are realities. But they have to be seen in the framework of the overall situation in the Arab world as well. We Arabs have to turn a look at our own cruel realities and deal with them. We cannot always blame someone else. What has happened, the really destructive thing, is not that people talk about all the terrible things that happen in the West Bank. What has happened is a language has evolved that stops you from looking at yourself internally, looking inward, looking self-critically, examine. Yes, people denounce regimes and archaic monarchies and this, that, and the other, but that is not what I'm talking about. They don't look really hard. They blame, for instance, the civil war in Lebanon on Israel or on the United States because it didn't take this, that, or the other policy, instead of looking at oneself. Again, colonialism, imperialism, the West, Israel are always out there to peg every problem onto. This has turned into a sickness, a disease, in the culture, in the politics, in the way of thinking, the way of constructing one's categories, and the way of deciding who one is. Now, if a Palestinian can only think of himself only as somebody who has been always victimized by Israel, it's a deeply unhealthy way of seeing the world. It's very hedgehog-like, prickly, defensive.
You said that once when you were in the occupied territories in Israel, you were watching two Israeli soldiers search a terrified Arab boy.
Yes.
And you understood watching that, how this young Arab boy could see Saddam as a savior.
And I know that if I'd been in his position, I probably would see Saddam as a savior myself.
Those are strong words for you to
they
say,
are.
Yeah.
But just put yourself in his position. I mean, it is sometimes not just the killing of people, it's the humiliation. That little boy was humiliated beyond belief, grows up with this as a formative part of his experience. He doesn't know, he doesn't see the outside world. I understand where he's coming from. My anger, my criticism is not directed at him, nor at people who have had their horizons locked and shut in by being frozen in places that are so repressive and so antithetical to any form of opening up, to finding out what's going on in the rest of the world. No, my criticism is specifically directed at those cosmopolitan, westernized Arab intellectuals who are, by and large, able to say what they want to say, whether they're in North Africa, many countries of North Africa, or in Jordan, or in the West. There are countries where they can speak out, and there are large, large numbers of them now in universities all over the West. These people took up a position which is shameful in retrospect and which has to be examined self-critically. And they are the people I criticize.
It sounds like one of the things you're saying is that in the Arab-Israeli dispute, you have troubles with both sides, that you're not all on one side or all on another side.
That's right.
You're trying not to simplify the situation into one side is completely right, one side is completely wrong.
I think that way of putting things, everybody's either pro-Israel, pro-Arab, has destroyed the cutting across boundaries, which is what I want to be all about. This way of looking at things has led us nowhere. Arabness versus Israeliness, Maronite against Shiite, Shiite and Sunnite in Iraq, and the same thing played out all over the Arab world. This constant regression into smaller and smaller units of identification, that is the disease. That is the malaise I'm talking about. It leads to an inability to empathize, to have compassion for the other, to understand the other. So how can you possibly live together if you don't even have that? And this has happened. Palestinians and Israelis, Shiites and Sunnites, Kurds and Arabs. It's happening all over the Middle East. Maronites and Shiites and so on. It's happening all over the Middle East. This is the malaise. This, where is it coming from?
Do you think that militant fundamentalism in Arab countries is one of the subjects that has become very difficult to talk about?
Yes. It's approached in very generic categories, as though it's one thing, when it's a very complex phenomenon. Fundamentalism is different in Egypt than it is in Tunisia, than it is in Iraq, than it is in one place after another. You cannot deal with these phenomena by just talking about one thing called militant Islamic fundamentalism from one end of the Arab world to the other. It just takes us nowhere. It leads to simplifications which are more useless. And in analyzing what's going on, number one. And the other thing it takes us away from is the failure of a modern secular intelligentsia to formulate the categories with which to confront its world. Why is there such a growth of such a return to old, to Islam, to regressive ideas of identity? Or even why is there, not necessarily regressive ideas, or attempt to put them in Islamic categories? Because the secular intellectuals have failed so often. And that, I think, is part of the problem. The culture is poorer because of the absence of a secular, democratic, human rights-centered critique of the existing Arab order. And that vacuum is filled by the fundamentalists, naturally. Now, they come along and they deal with real problems the way they did in Egypt. They come along, for instance, after the earthquake, and they do a much better job than the state itself. Issuing relief and so on and so forth, and they build on that. Now, their language, their categories, their ideas of politics are very primitive, but they are beginning to do in society at large what other secular intellectuals are not doing. The failure is here. We, secular, democratic, human rights-centered intellectuals, need to now develop a critique of existing Arab order, one which reaches out, one which makes of cruelty a priority, one which makes of human rights, individual rights, a absolutely central, pivotal point, one that does not always rest on blaming someone else for your own failures.
I know that during part of the Iran-Iraq war, you were married and your wife was Iranian. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if that brought up a lot of family complications, if anybody in her family or your family supported the war, and if there was a lot of tension because of that.
No. Neither one of our families supported the war. She and I both took exactly the same position, and she had returned to Iran. She was an activist as well in the sort of struggle to overthrow the Shah, and she also opposed. She led the first women's demonstration against the enforced wearing of the veil in Iran, and then she had to quickly get out. She got out by the skin of her teeth in 1980 and started essentially a new life outside. We, our relationship strengthened, if anything, as a consequence of that war. It led to us questioning our whole past, because many of our previous allies, contacts, friends on the left took sides, which was a catastrophic mistake, and showed that for me was an important signal that time had come to rethink my whole way of thinking about Middle East politics.
Took sides in the Iran-Iraq war?
Yeah, largely on the side of Iran, often. The left, which is what I was part of, often sided up on the basis that this was some genuine revolution, and therefore you had to support this. I mean, there were, of course, all kinds of complications, but both of us took the position that this war was deeply, equally regressive on both sides, that the intentions of both sides were totally not to be supported, and could only lead to death and destruction of Iraqis and Iranians. And both of us set a plague on both your houses. That was our position.
Did what you're saying about the Iran-Iraq war help formulate the criticisms that you expressed earlier about Arab intellectuals in the West?
I would say the Iraq-Iran war was not that prominent in Arab intellectual discourse. It was there. Many Arabs got swept up with the excitement of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. I was not one of those. Many switched sides from being, for instance, Marxists to suddenly Islamists overnight. This was quite a common transformation. Many thought that the Islamic character of this revolution was not important, really. It would pass with time, that this was a genuine popular mobilization, the like of which the Third World hadn't seen. That the most important thing about it was that it was directed against the United States. It was anti-West again, the great Satan, and so on. See, anti-imperialism and the great Satan are very similar, just different words for the same sort of way of thinking. One is a concept used by a secular Arab intellectual. The other is Khomeini's characterization, the Islamic movement, to my way of seeing things in this book and my general way of seeing things now. These are just different vocabularies for basically the same attitude, stance, which is what I'm criticizing, which is why this critique really goes beyond just this or that type of intellectual. It's about a way of constructing one's world, a way of describing it as always, for instance, having external enemies who are constantly trying to disrupt it, whereas everything would be running smoothly. That is a false way of understanding ourselves. I want to turn inward. I want to be critical. I want us to use that as a point of departure.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Kanan Makiya is the author of the new book Cruelty and Silence: War, Tyranny, Uprising, and the Arab World. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, Harry Shearer, The Early Days. Shearer is a satirist whose work is heard on All Things Considered and his own program, The Show. He's the voice of Mr. Burns and many other characters on The Simpsons. He's also a former cast member of Saturday Night Live. We'll talk with him about his days as a child actor, working with Jack Benny, Mel Blanc, and Abbott and Costello. And if you liked Harry satirizing heavy metal music in Spinal Tap, you'll want to hear about his latest musical endeavor, The Folksman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Secretary of Defense Les Aspin has ordered U.S. military services to end a ban on women flying on combat missions. At the same time, the secretary ordered that women be allowed to serve on most U.S. naval warships. The Pentagon says this means that women can be in combat planes within months and in attack helicopters within a year. Aspin has also told the armed services to justify reasons for keeping women out of ground combat units and to look at jobs for women in field artillery and air defense combat units. On Capitol Hill, lawmakers continue to be divided over whether the U.S. should take any military action against Serbian factions in Bosnia. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Members of the Senate Armed Services Committee met today in a closed session to discuss the policy options facing the United States. Many lawmakers are concerned with the risk that the U.S. might get sucked into a conflict that requires gradual escalation of force. While there is no agreement that the United States should initiate limited airstrikes, Virginia Republican John Warner says members of the committee are considering lifting the arms embargo on the Bosnian Muslims.
Some consensus is forming. I think there's a strong consensus forming behind the thought that we should withdraw the embargo that was placed by the West through the United Nations.
Warner said the jury is still out on other military action. Earlier in the day, the committee heard senior Pentagon officials express deep reservations about U.S. military action in the Balkans. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the Capitol.
Also in Washington, President Clinton announced today that he is nominating former New York City Police Commissioner Lee Brown to head the nation's anti-drug effort. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
If confirmed by the Senate, Lee Brown will head what's officially known as the Office of National Drug Control Policy, an agency about to undergo major changes. Mr. Clinton has proposed slashing the office's funding and reducing its staff from 146 to just 25 people as part of cost-cutting efforts. But the president has also elevated the drug czar to cabinet status and vows that the upgraded position will be able to oversee drug control efforts in other federal agencies. Speaking at the White House today, Lee Brown said his approach will include more than just tough law enforcement.
We have to deal with education and prevention. We have to deal with treatment. The demand side is critical if we're going to make progress in addressing this problem.
In addition to heading New York's police force, Brown has led the police departments of Atlanta and Houston. I'm Andy Bowers at the White House.
In Germany, steel workers and engineers in the eastern part of the nation have voted in favor of a strike. This clears the way for the first major strike in the former East Germany in 60 years. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 2 points to close at 3,413.50 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. Testifying today on Capitol Hill, Attorney General Janet Reno said that she considered every possibility to end the standoff at the Branch Davidian compound near Waco, Texas. But the only viable plan appeared to be the tear gas attack. Reno, who took office in the middle of the 51-day standoff, said she had experts explain every option, including digging a tunnel into the cult's compound. And she said to allow things to continue as they were was not going to lead to a peaceful resolution. Reno said the cult had too much firepower and all other options endangered the lives of the federal agents or the children inside the compound. In Mexico City, more than 40 people, all children, have been hospitalized with cholera, and local officials are rushing to try to stem the outbreak. Bibi Kraus reports from Mexico City.
The outbreak is taking place in a poor area in the north of the city. So So far, some 160 people are believed to have contracted the disease. The source of the problem is thought to be a contaminated well, which people began using when their regular water supply was cut off. Symptoms began April 4th, but authorities managed to keep a lid on the story until this week. There is fear that news of a cholera outbreak could hurt the tourist industry, one of Mexico's most important sources of foreign revenue. The government has dispatched dozens of state health workers to the area. Cholera thrives in places without proper sewage and where sanitation is poor. So the health brigades are testing water supplies and going door to door with information on the prevention and control of the disease. For National Public Radio, this is Bibi Kraus in Mexico City.
According to a spokesman for British Prime Minister John Major, Major wants the Clinton administration to back away from a plan to arm Bosnian Muslims, and in return, he may give his support to airstrikes against Serbs. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Back with us for a return visit is satirist Harry Shearer. You'll recognize his voice for lots of reasons. He's the voice of Mr. Burns, Principal Skinner, and lots of other characters on The Simpsons. He's a former cast member of Saturday Night Live, and he does the voices of our political leaders and news anchors in his satire on All Things Considered and his own program, Le Show. Shearer is also bass player Derek Smalls in Spinal Tap, the parody of a heavy metal band. He got started in showbiz as a child actor. Tomorrow night at the Museum of Television and Radio in New York, Shearer will present a retrospective of his career, and we're about to do a mini-retrospective focusing on the early years, since we've already talked with him about his recent work. As if to make sure no medium goes unrepresented, now Shearer has a new book, a collection of columns he wrote for the Los Angeles Times Sunday magazine. It's called Man Bites Town. And I wanted to know if he's finding sneaky ways to promote it on his radio show.
No, I've avoided most sneaky ways. I mentioned a couple times that I was doing book signings, but and I have the publicist from my publisher staring at me in the face as I say this. But I always view the the publicizing of my stuff as their job, you know, not to be something where I take time that people like set aside to be entertained by me and say, you know, instead, no, buy this other stuff that I'm selling to be entertained, you know. But I do mention it from time to time.
You have a talk and a retrospective coming up at the Museum of Television and Radio.
Yeah.
So I thought we might walk through briefly some of your TV career and go through some of the highlights of that part of your life. Now, I have a friend who recently saw you on the pilot, he thinks it was, or the first episode of Leave It to Beaver.
It was the pilot.
The pilot.
Mm-hmm.
What did you play?
Eddie Haskell.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You were Eddie Haskell?
Yeah.
Oh, he told me you were Eddie Haskell's friend. You were Eddie Haskell.
Yeah.
You were the obnoxious friend.
Yeah.
What happened? You didn't get the part?
My parents took the position that it was fine for me to work on TV and radio as a child, but they didn't want me being in a series. I think their reasoning was that it would take me out of school. I was going to, like, regular public school, and then when I'd get a job, I'd go work and come back to school. If you're in a series, you're just in that world forever. You know, you never go back to public school, and you're on the set all the time. I now realize later, with the hindsight that I've accumulated in show business, that it's also not a good idea for a 9- or 10-year-old kid to have, you know, 200 guys on the crew standing around going, kid looks off this week. You know, their paycheck is dependent on a 9-year-old and the pressure of those guys watching him. Kids losing the cuteness a little bit here. What's happening? You know, you don't want that. So I'm very glad that happened.
You'd have to be in a self-help group now for...
for aging child stars.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, they all have such problems.
Yeah. Not that I don't have problems, Terry, but...
Well, at least they're different problems.
That's right.
I know when I was growing up, a lot of times when there were child actors... And some of what I'm thinking is, of course, from films that were made a little earlier. But a lot of the child actors, the male child actors, were in short pants,
mm-hmm.
and were really whiny and obnoxious.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have to play that type of person?
No, because I was dark haired, I basically played like Italian street kids, you know, who had to be rescued from a life of having a gangland name attached to them by the time they were, you know, get this kid and save him before somebody starts calling him the Chin, you know, parts like that. There's a lot of typecasting with children, you know, and if you're blonde or redheaded and freckle-faced, why, you get different parts than if you're dark-haired.
Did you ever play anybody Jewish?
Ostensibly Jewish? No, I don't think so.
I don't think there were many ostensibly Jewish characters.
About the only one I would have, I guess, would have been if people knew I played Jack Benny as a child a couple times on his show. And if they figured out that Jack Benny was Jewish, then they might have figured out that I was playing a Jewish character.
Was Jack Benny nice to you?
He was the greatest. I did his show a lot. After the third time I did his radio show, he came out into the hallway behind the studio after the show was over, gave me this huge hug, and gave me a transcription of the show that we just finished. And it was just, from then on, it was he was so warm and kind to me. He was very generous, very smart, very generous in the sense of liking the fact, not just allowing the people around him to get laughs, but really liking the fact that the supporting players on his program got laughs. I remember vividly the first time I made him laugh in a rehearsal. We were reading the script and sitting around a table, and I ad-libbed a little thing. And I mean, I was a kid. I was, 8 or 9 years old, and to see Jack Benny not just laugh, but, I mean, laugh uproariously and hit the table was so amazing.
What did you say? I mean, what did you say that got him laughing?
I was playing, the Beverly Hills Beavers were doing their version of Jack Benny's radio show, so I was playing Sheldon Leonard, the guy who played the racetrack. Hey, bud, come here a minute. I got hit. I forget exactly what I said. It may have just been something I did with my voice. I don't know, but I mean, I remember I did a little something, and all of a sudden Jack Benny is like hitting, pounding the table, laughing. It was easy for him to be generous in giving the supporting players around him laughs, because he always knew he could get a great laugh by reacting to them. That said, a lot of people in show business, a lot of people in comedy, aren't that smart to know that they can always get a good laugh by reacting and get very jealous of people around them getting any laughs at all. He was also one of the first people I knew who owned his own show.
Oh.
Very smart guy.
One thing I always loved about Jack Benny, one of the many things, is that he could just make that, that little, like, annoyed smirk that he'd have when he'd hold his two fingers up to his chin, and he'd just roll his eyes a little and look away. He'd get so much out of that one gesture.
Yeah.
Did that give you ideas when you were young and watching him?
What gave me, what really inspired me was watching him have this character that, if you analyzed his character, or any of the great comic characters, but let's take Benny. He was a miser, he was vain, he was a bad employer, he was all these comically unpleasant things, and yet he was beloved. And, you flash forward to the recent past, and television executives particularly, and also movie executives, have had the idea that comic characters had to be, quote, likable. That is to say, they had to be characters composed of likable characteristics. Well, likable characteristics aren't funny. Which is why you have characters in sitcoms with no definable character just trading wisecracks with each other. Because there's nothing funny about the characters, that's all been shaved off. Benny showed, marvelously well how lovable you can be being not lovable.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Harry Shearer. And Harry has a new book called Man Bites Town. That's a collection of columns that he used to write for the magazine of the Los Angeles Times. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Harry Shearer. You might have told me this before in another interview, I'm not sure, but how...
I never repeat myself, Terry.
I never asked a question twice. How did you get started as an actor at so young an age?
I had a piano teacher starting from when I was four, and I like to think that I helped her make the decision to have a career change. And she decided to become a children's agent, and partly because she had a child of her own who was working in show business, so she had those connections. And she said to my parents, for reasons best known to her, do you mind if I try to get Harry some work? And they said, sure. And 7 or 8 months went by, and it was sort of like a family joke. Have we heard from Mrs. McMillan yet? No. And then she called up one day and said, there's an audition for the Jack Benny Show. And I went in and got it.
So that was your first part?
That was my first thing I did in show business, yeah.
And when was Beaver in relation to that?
It was about 3 years later. I think I was 10.
When I was growing up, I thought, if I really reach that pinnacle, I'll be able to meet someone from the Mickey Mouse Club and befriend them. You know, I mean, I just thought, like, wow, wouldn't it be swell to know somebody was actually on television?
Mm.
And what was it like for you to actually be on the box?
Well, I really loved that world. I mean, it was an escape from what I found to be the incredibly boring world of my fellow children. So anytime I could go into that world, it was just, hey, this is where I want to be. You know, it was cool. I got to school was wrapped up, pardon me, in like 3 hours. You'd have the tutor on the set, and they'd do school real fast to get you ready for work. And then you were either working, and that was fun, or you'd sit around, you know, reading the trades and eating good food for lunch at the commissary and hanging around with grown-ups. You know, it was so hip. I loved it.
Who were some of the people who took you under their wing or tried to introduce you to things that kids weren't supposed to be introduced to? A lot of adults really take pride in doing that.
Well, I my best memory in terms of a guy who took me under his wing, and it's either ironic or fitting given what I've been doing in later life, was Mel Blanc, who was the great voice genius of the Warner Brother cartoons and was also one of the regulars in the Jack Benny Show. And I'll never forget, it was very early on in my career on the Benny Show, but my parents always used to sit upstairs, and this was the radio show, and there were two booths. There was a control room behind glass where the crew sat, you know, the technical crew, and there was a booth upstairs also behind glass where the sponsors sat and where, you know, guests could sit too. It was called the client's booth, and my parents would always sit there. They'd watch me from above, and I could always get eye contact with them by looking up there. And one show they decided, we're going to go see what it looks like from out in the audience. So they do that. And before the show begins, Don Wilson, we're all standing out in the hallway, and Don Wilson, the announcer of the show, introduces every cast member to the audience. And so when you hear Don Wilson call your name, you walk into the studio, take a bow, and sit down. And we're standing out in the hallway talking, and I hear, Harry! And I open the door and walk in. And instead of getting my little usual smattering of applause, I get a huge laugh. And I think I probably looked down to check my zipper, and that was okay, and sat down, and Mel Blanc was sitting there next to me. He'd already been introduced, and he explained to me that the reason they were laughing was because Don Wilson hadn't been introducing me. He'd been calling Mary from Mary Livingston. And I was, you know, destroyed. I couldn't find my parents anywhere. They were out in the audience where I couldn't see him, and he was just, you know, he made it possible for me to go on that night. But he was very sweet and kind to me all the way through the time that I knew him on the Benny Show.
What did he do that made you feel better?
Just, you know, talk to me about, you know, it was funny and it's not a bad thing to get a laugh. And, you know, that they're not down on me because of it. And I didn't screw up the show. And, you know, explained all the things that a child at that point might be afraid that he'd done, which I was.
Your parents, I believe, were immigrants from Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm.
What did they make of you being in the middle of American popular culture when they were so new to the culture?
I think they were proud. It got them into a world that they would never have experienced otherwise. You know, they were, I think they were, the thing that amazed them most was the other parents of the kids. You know, they would look around at the behavior of these other parents of kids and just shake their heads in amazement that people could be like this with their kids and with other grown-ups. You know, it, as we were talking before, you know, the parents of a lot of child actors have some serious problems and very often force the kids into the business, and you see that behavior close at hand, and I think that shocked them more than anything else.
Where were they from?
My mom is from Poland and my dad was from Austria.
And what did they do for a living?
Well, you know, as immigrants, they did what they had to. That's not to say they violated any laws. My dad had trained as an opera singer, and he ran a gas station. And my mom had been educated as an accountant and ended up being a restaurant bookkeeper.
Right. Okay, let's continue our procession through your early acting career.
Okay.
Any other TV shows I should know about from the early days, from Harry Shearer, the early days?
Probably the most significant other ones I did were Alfred Hitchcock and Ann Southern.
Ann Southern, where she was the secretary?
Yeah, yeah. That was one where I was like a bad kid whom she rescues from the streets. And the most prestigious show I ever did, in the early days of television, there was this wonderful Sunday afternoon program called Omnibus, which sort of was an all-purpose arts show that covered the waterfront, and I did that once when Jack Benny was recreating his historic flop movie, The Horn Blows at Midnight. But I did, you know, an awful lot of what was going on at that time in television.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were on GE Theater, right? Mm-hmm. Is that the one Ronald Reagan hosted?
Yeah, it sure was. Mm-hmm. Darian, it was, he'd not only host it, but he'd go out to the GE plants all over the country and do the thing with the light bulb and such.
Did you meet him?
No.
Oh, what a shame.
Yeah, what a shame. He came in and did all his stuff, you know, at one time. You know, he'd host 20 shows at a crack and then go off and do his touring of the, do the hello and say the fellas, you're making good light bulbs, keep it up, you know, do that.
Oh, gee, I'm so disappointed that you didn't meet him. You could have, you know, you could have started studying him at an early age.
At an early age. You can't study people at an early age. I have a very distinct memory of being on the radio with partners of mine and talking about the people who were difficult to do. And at the time, Reagan was governor of California, and we agreed that he was one of the most difficult people to do. But as public figures get older, possibly because they learn what it is that works and keep doing that, they increasingly become caricatures of themselves. And so they save you the effort. You don't have to caricature them. You just do them. And he became incredibly easy to do as time went on. I think that that's, you know, that they all have handlers and advisors who tell them, do this. This is what works. And that's what sort of makes them narrower and narrower, narrower and narrower as people and easier to do as a result.
Mm-hmm. What was the last time that you had an acting role, you know, as a young person?
I was 15. It was probably a Benny show or a series that was on called at that time called TV Reader's Digest, in which I guess they took stories from the magazine and condensed them further for television.
Well, that sounds exciting.
Yeah. For people for whom the Reader's Digest was tough reading.
Was this a conscious effort to give up the business?
Yeah, I made it. I retired from the business at the age of 15 because I was starting college, and I thought, I breezed my way through school, and I thought, well, college I'm going to have to take seriously. And about the first week I got there, I went to work for the school paper, and there went that notion.
So what got you back into show business?
Trying jobs that weren't in show business.
Trying and failing?
No, not failing, just not liking them as much as I like show business.
Uh-huh.
I taught school for a couple of years. I wrote journalism. I wrote advertising. I worked at the state legislature in California. And when I had the opportunity to do this stuff again, I thought, yeah, more fun.
My guest is Harry Shearer. More in a minute. This is Fresh Air. The debate continues about what the United States should do in Bosnia. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what will you have on that continuing debate on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll be hearing from a U.S. senator who is against U.S. military intervention. Yesterday, we heard from a senator who supports intervention. Also, a talk with one of the ambassadors to the United Nations who is part of a fact-finding mission to Srebrenica, the eastern Bosnian town that's been under siege, have been besieged by Bosnian Serb forces. And we'll be hearing from Deborah Amos about the somewhat ambivalent attitude of the European powers toward plans for military intervention. Also, a talk today with Ted Lewin, artist and illustrator, I'll give you the title of his new book for young adults. It's I Was a Teenage Professional Wrestler.
Oh, great. Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. My guest is satirist, actor, and writer Harry Shearer. You've talked with us before on the show about Spinal Tap, the parody of the heavy metal band that you've been a part of for years. But you've got another band that you're going to be doing more with, and that's called The Folksmen.
Yes.
Tell us about The Folksmen.
Well, The Folksmen is a superannuated folk trio that broke up about 25 years ago.
Do they have a PBS special yet?
No, they don't, but it should be in the cards. They'll be appearing at a folk fest. They opened for Spinal Tap in London. If you saw our television special or see our video, they were attempting to open for Spinal Tap at Royal Albert Hall, but were booed off the stage before they ever set foot on it. And they'll be making their first actual public appearance in Los Angeles at an actual bona fide folk festival coming up in June. And their repertoire includes a song which is not so much a traditional folk ballad as a summation of most traditional folk ballads. It centers around a train wreck inside a coal mine called Blood on the Coal. And they've gotten together recently. You know, they all have other jobs. One of them teaches at Swarthmore, and they're still politically active, you know, as folk people have to be. And two of them have no hair, and one of them has hair that of suspicious origins.
And who are you?
I'm the guy, one of the guys with no hair. I'm the bass player. I'm probably the most politically committed of the group. I'm always trying to get songs about the Spanish Civil War back into our repertoire. And I have that awful little beard that never comes above the chin line, you know?
What are the folk bands that you particularly liked or hated, the folk groups?
Well, Kingston Trio, you had to hate, you know. They were the great boilers down of every tradition. And I have to go on record, since you've asked me this question, saying I really never liked Dylan. He wrote, you know, about a dozen good songs early on and has been coasting for the last 30 years on his reputation. And now makes public appearances where he sounds like he's been breathing helium right before going on stage. who did I like in folk? Well, I love Joni Mitchell and Joan Baez, you know. And there was this guy who used to sing folk songs and had radio shows from time to time, would rescue really obscure folk songs. Oscar Brand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like he used to be on NPR,
yes,
actually.
He did.
Yeah. So listen, when you're doing the folk group, are you good at singing the tight harmonies that folk groups sing
mm-hmm.
in?
Yeah, yeah. We'll be doing that. We'll be very tight.
All right. Well, Harry, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, Terry. It was always a pleasure.
Satirist Harry Shearer, his new collection of columns from the Los Angeles Times is called Man Bites Town. Tomorrow, he speaks at the Museum of Television and Radio in New York. Here's Harry Shearer as Mr. Burns from The Simpsons. I'm Terry Gross.
Smithers, Turn on the surveillance monitors.
Yes, sir.
It's worse than I thought. Each morning at 9, they trickle through the gate. They go home early. They come in late. Reeking of cheap liquor, they stumble through the day. Never give a thought to honest work for honest pay. I know it shouldn't vex me. I shouldn't take it hard. I should ignore their capering with a kingly disregard. But
look at all those idiots.
Oh, look at all those boobs.
An office full of morons.
A factory full of fools.
Is it any wonder
that I'm singing the blues?
Yours is a heavy burden, sir.
I'm just getting started. They make personal phone calls on company time. They Xerox their buttockses and guess who pays the dime? Their blatant thievery wounds me. Their ingratitude astounds. I long to lure them to my home and then release the hounds. I shouldn't grow unsettled when faced with such abuse. I shouldn't let it plague me.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about racial conflict in America with Cornel West, director of the African American Studies Department at Princeton and author of the new book, Race Matters. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.